an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, buddy. So I want to congratulate the celebrants, and yes, like, if you come to this meeting, there's a lot of new people here, so that's great. And there's a lot of people who've been around a long time, and they're here for a different reason, and I think they know why, you know, because they're looking for something more, and you're going to find it in this kind of meeting. There's all kind of meetings. This is a great meeting that, as I said, delivers a message. I, too, when I, the first of whatever it was, 14 times I tried to quit, I was selling an ounce of cocaine in a week and smoking marijuana, and I was not drinking, so I tell everybody how wonderful it was that I was sober. That's how dumb I was. I'm sober. I'm not drinking. You need to get sober. You know, and that's that didn't last long, but that's where I started, and it took a long time. So anyway, last week we talked about, you know, I got sober. It's such a privilege to present in this room. This is where I came about 30 years ago. I don't have 30 years. I have 26 years. Maybe it's more like 33 years ago. And I came here. It was set up different. But I sat way back in the corner there. I didn't want anybody to talk to me. There was a guy who would always come say hi to me, though, a guy named Joe Moore, and it made me so uncomfortable. But it made me feel welcome. And, you know, I'm here to talk about, you know, go through the big book, mainly under with the idea of passing it on, you know, sponsorship. And service, and that's I think that's the greatest form of service any of us can do, is make the new guy or girl feel welcome, and the guys make the new guys feel welcome, and the girls make the new girls feel welcome. Please understand that, okay? It's and I'll try to stop there. I've try to leave it there. Again, they wrote the big book was written in, they started it in 1937 with the idea of to place a message in writing that had gotten the first, at that point, about 40 people sober. They wanted to put it down exactly how these people had done it, because it was getting diluted back then after 2 years, and now it's diluted. There's a lot of reasons for that. The other one was to mail it out. You know, there was a group in Akron, a group in New York, and a group in Cleveland, and they wanted to spread the message. They realized they had they had found a way for people like us to get sober, to overcome our alcohol problem, and they wanted to be able to transmit that in writing via book, you know, and they also wanted to try to get really rich by writing this book. That was the main idea, was to really get rich, and that will go over. That did not happen, luckily, for all of us, but we will go over that as we go through it. So I'm going to jump right into it tonight, because I just want to make sure I'm on track. So we are on the foreword to the second edition. This is what I like to do. I like to, when I read with guys, and, you know, here's the thing, and it's back there. I was going to get up and go get it. You know, there's a thing back there in the corner, and what it's from Dr. Bob's prescription pad, which now all our doctors write opiates on them, but or pain, some sort of painkiller. But Dr. Bob wrote this to somebody, and it's a prescription for a spiritual awakening. You know, if you want, the prescription for a spiritual awakening is trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's all this is. You know, that's all this is we have to make a decision to turn ourselves over to God. We need to go through the steps, and that's clean house. And then the thing I missed for years and years and years and years was we have to help others. You know, I came in and out of this room, and I always call it, I was here for an oil change. You know, I wanted to get things better, And once it was better, I got it. I'm going to go now and go get back into life and catch up with all my friends who have grown up, you know, and are, you know, married. And I, you know, I said I had 11 90-day pins. I had 2 1-year coins. I had a 2-year coin. I relapsed. And then I finally surrendered. And that was in 1991. So let's start, you know, so when I read with guys, I really emphasize that we're pretending you're in Texas. There's no such thing as AA. I love AA, but I used it as a safety net, you know, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of us do. I used it as a safety net, and so I always thought if I get in trouble, I can come back here. Back in 1939, there's no AA, you know, or 1937 or 1930, there's no AA. You know, there's no such thing as AA. There's no detoxes or rehabs that you can just with the revolving door. You went to an asylum. You know, if you were a repeat alcoholic offender, you went to an asylum like Abby Thatcher was going to, and you went until you got better. It wasn't 28 days. It could be your wife could send you there, and she could leave you there for 10 years, you know. She had to sign you out. So it was a lot different back then, and that's important to me. You know, in the last plug, if you're new, I'll do this for the women. If you're new, you know, it says, and it'll say here, that we have to have a message of depth and weight. And what really got me about 10 years into recovery was it says in the last page that we read, you know, of doing this work, page 164 in The Road to Happy Destiny, it says, obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. Mm-hmm. And it hit me, I was like, well, what do I really have, you know? And I went to that, I did that Berkeley Heights workshop, you know, I'd done that. But all of a sudden I was like, I need to start. So I started reading, this is the first book I read, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, you know, if you know, read this. I'm not going to candy coat it. Start with this. This will make you cry. This will make you understand how lucky we are to be here. This will also, for you women, realize, you know, Bill Wilson was a good guy, but he was not a perfect man. The brains behind the operation was really Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife. She was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful woman. She brought God into this. Her sister Ignatia, Henrietta Cyberling, they were the ones who just God. And like you said, you know, I didn't have a problem with God. I just didn't see how God could help me, you know. And today I do, you know. So read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I've got a lot of books. I love reading these books now because when I see how hard these people work to get this going for us, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. We're so lucky, and I took it for granted for so long, and I feel guilty about that. I feel it just makes me every day so grateful for AA, and you know that's part of the spiritual awakening. But anyway, I'll read the forward to the first and second edition. This is how I do it. It says in the beginning of this, it says, since the original foreword to this book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. Our earliest printing voiced the hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. So that was their hope. So we're here today. You know, and again, it was only in Akron at the time in Cleveland, and now it's 1955, it's spread, but you know, you can actually, after this meeting, if you want, you can crawl to the next meeting. It's right down the street here, you know. You can walk if you want, but you could theoretically crawl, you know. And that's how lucky we are. AA is everywhere now. And I'll skip around here. You know, it's been 16 years, and at this point now they have 150,000 recovered alcoholics, and that's, we talked about being recovered. At the bottom, and this is a great part, it says, and again, this was written by the first 40 to 100 people. So, well, it's 100, you know, now it's 1955, but so every word in the book was really, really scrutinized. But it says here, the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between the New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. So that's Bill Wilson meeting with Dr. Bob. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend, that's Ebbie Thatcher, who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth. So Dr. Bob was approached by Ebbie Thatcher, and we'll get into that, but Ebbie Thatcher got the message from a guy named Roland Hazard, who had lived with Dr. Carl Jung. The older people probably know who he is. He's like Tony Robbins, or it was Sigmund Freud, and Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, and some other guy. They were the main guys back then, and the Roland Hazard family was so rich that they could afford to send their son to go live with this guy for a year because he could not stop drinking. He was a spoiled little rich kid, and like a lot of us, and he could not stop drinking. And so he goes and lives with Carl Jung, and, you know, to sit with Tony Robbins is like $18,000 an hour. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what did this cost the guy to live with him? After a year and all the, you know, triggers and all this stuff we get to hear, Roland Hazard says, yeah, I'm good now. I'm good, you know. I'm good now. I appreciate it, Doc. Yeah, this is as good as it's going to get. He takes off and he drinks immediately. And he goes back, mm-hmm. and he says, you know, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And he says, there's no hope for you. And he said, the only hope for you is a vital spiritual experience or awakening or something. I've seen it from time to time, blah, blah. So Roland Hazard says, you know what, I believe in God. I'll go back and I'll go with the God thing. And Roland Hazard went to the Oxford group, you know. And the Oxford group was a first century evangelical Christian movement. And the Oxford group was for all of our sins. If we were cheating on our wife or we were gambling or we were whatever, we were stealing, whatever we were doing, the Oxford group said God can fix you, and we'll get into that in a little while. But so you have Carl Jung, who gave us what the solution was what is God, and Carl Jung is not an alcoholic. He passed it through to Roland Hazard, to Ebbie Thatcher, who, as help others, part of it was help others. Ebbie goes to Bill and delivers that message. Dr. Silkworth, and we'll get into that in a minute, Dr. Silkworth gave Bill the idea that of the mental obsession, the physical craving is what our problem is that we're different as alcoholics. And Ebbie also gave Bill, again from the Oxford group, again non-alcoholic people, the program of recovery, the tenets of the Oxford group at the time, which we'll talk about. So the beauty of the thing that really, and someone pointed out to me, is that Alcoholics Anonymous came from all non-alcoholic people. Bill Wilson was just in the middle of it, getting pieces from here and there and here and there, and kind of in his white light experience and through the Oxford group, he came up with a program of recovery perfectly suited for us, you know, perfectly suited and tailored for us. So, you know, I like to see God at work in this thing, and I clearly see it there. So, the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. And he was a saint. He gave us, I mean, think about, I mean, we're so lucky. When I had a drinking problem, and I thought that I'd go out with my friends, and at 10, I had to be home at 10 o'clock in high school, but 10 o'clock came, and I couldn't go home, right? I'm drinking, and all my friends went home, but I couldn't go home. And I thought I was just more fun than they were. I didn't understand. I didn't really understand. And you need to think about that. Think about your early drinking and the things you actually believed, you know. Or I'd go out after work and say I'm having two beers and guys would go home. And, And I would say, well, I'm going to stay for a few more. I thought, again, I just changed my mind, you know. I didn't realize I couldn't leave. I couldn't go home. I couldn't go home, you know. Once alcohol got in me, and Silkworth saw that, and we'll talk about that in a while. But think about, and that's your first step experience, is think about what you believed. But then somebody eventually told us quickly about AA, AA or rehab or detox or whatever it is. They didn't have any of that back then. So when Silkworth brought this concept to us, it made perfect sense to us, and it changed, really changed us. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford Group, and the tenets, if anybody has a pen, I write, the tenets of the Oxford Group are on page 263 of this book, and they're here too, so we'll talk about them. But it says, I think it's important to show those to a newcomer. I think it's important the newcomer sees where this all came from. It just adds, as we say, more depth and weight. He was convinced for the need of moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of a belief and a dependence upon God. And that's very helpful to me. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. And that is the truth. That is the truth. I mean, I work in a lot of detoxes and rehabs, and I get kicked out of a lot of detoxes and rehabs. Most of the people don't understand our problem. And the problem is most counselors in the industry are not in recovery. So I sold my grandmother's wedding ring to get cocaine. And I did 1,000 things like that, as we all did, you know. And so when you take away drugs and alcohol, and I've got all those things built, you know, and I'm sitting there with a counselor, especially you get these IOPs, you know, and they're reading a book, and they're like, oh, but they can't internalize it like we can. So we're the only ones who can help each other get better. That's my book. You know, I don't think anybody can change my mind on that. On the theory that one alcoholic could help another alcoholic, but he had been succeeded in only keeping himself sober. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized, thank God for us, he suddenly realized to save himself, he must carry the message to an alcoholic, and that alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. So what I don't like about the big book is when you read all these other books, these stories are so, you know, they're 40 pages long, the trip to Akron, and, you know, and then if you really read them in detail, they're really amazing and bring a whole new thing to what we're doing here. But it says here, the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but failed. Dr. Bob's wife was, Ann Smith, was a diehard member of the Oxford Group, really for her husband, you know, and she would bring Dr. Bob, he would go, but it did nothing for him. It says here, though, but when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered, never to drink again, to the moment of his death of cancer in 1950. So once Bill explained the mental obsession, the physical craving, and that we're different than other people, and I don't want to get off on a tangent, but that's when Dr. Bob said, yeah, that's what's happening to me. You know, that's it. Yeah, once I start, I can't stop. And Bill talked about his drinking. The reason Bill had failed so much is he would go into a bar and say to you, man, you got a problem. God came to me and fixed me. God's got to fix you. Come on, I'll get you with God. And you'd be like, get out of here, man. You know, get you know, move on down the bar, buddy. And so you know, Bill really was taking the wrong approach. And Silkworth said, you know, Bill, why don't you tell them about alcoholism? Talk to them about your drinking. And the first guy he tried it out on was Dr. Bob. You know, they got together, and we'll read more about that later, but they got together, and Bob talked to him. Bill went to Bob, and he didn't care if Bob got sober. He just needed to talk to him so he could stay sober, you know. And when he talked to him about his drinking, they connected. Dr. Bob related, and he got this concept of the mental obsession, or they called it more of an allergy, and the physical craving. So here, this is important. This is the theme of what I try to bring to you guys that it helped me so much. It says here, this seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another alcoholic as no non-alcoholic could. And that is the whole ball of wax. Now here it says, it also indicated that strenuous work, so they use the word strenuous work. It's not some work or it's strenuous work. One alcoholic with another was vital. It doesn't say important, it says vital to permanent recovery. And I should probably be looking these words up in the dictionary and reading them to you. But it is. It's vital to, whenever you see someone, you know, with 8 years who goes out and relapse, most of the time, you'll hear so-and-so went out, you know, he had 8 years. Now, usually so-and-so's not going to many meetings, but I'll always ask him, were you sponsoring? How many guys were you sponsoring, you know? And usually the answer is none. Or I had sponsored people, but I was no longer sponsoring people. So, you know, it says here, one alcoholic with another was vital to permanent recovery. So it says here, hence the two men worked almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. So they were lucky Dr. Bob had access to this hospital where they had drunks coming in. This is God working. Their very, very first case, a desperate one, this is Bill Dodson, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. He never had another drink. But, so they get the first guy, Bill Dodson, and that we read about him further on in the book. It says, this work in Akron continued for the summer of 35. It says there were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. I think the next year and a half, they only got 7 people sober. You know, I think that's the statistic. So I think they went for 6 months after Bill Dodson and got nobody. And I don't know about you guys, but my half measure approach in the beginning, if I didn't get anybody for the next 6 days, I probably would have given up and folded the tent and gone on to a new gimmick, and there'd be, you know, there'd be no AA. These guys stuck with it, thank God for us. The broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935. The first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. So it was Bill Dodson, it was Dr. Bob, and I think there was another guy, it might have been a guy named Ernie, it's in this book here, but he left 3 behind him. A second small group took shape in New York in 1937 with the start of a third in Cleveland, followed in 1937. Cleveland was very successful. There's a guy named Clarence Snyder started that group. He had great success. He was a bit of a nut job, but he really had great success. And if you can, what do they call it, YouTube anything on him, he's really interesting to listen to. A second small group promptly took shape in New York. Besides these 3, there were some scattered Akron, New York. By late 1937, the number of members having substantial sobriety behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of alcoholism. So this is a great story that I have to breeze over it, but Bill went back to Akron in 37, and he goes to see Dr. Bob. He's back there on business, the same business that had failed the first time, and like a good alcoholic, he can't let it go. And just talking, you know, he says, well, we've got 17 people in New York, you know, who have 6 months of sobriety. And that was a big deal back then, you know, and that's I think we take that for, you know, 90 days is a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal, you know. And I think now people have, you know, 20 years. So the 90-day people, that's a big, that's, you know, those are the hardest days too, you know. So anyway, they had 17 in New York. They had like 20 in Akron. And they were shocked now that they had, you know, roughly 40 people. After 2 years of this, they had 40 people who were not drinking. And that doesn't sound like much to us, but it was. And if you read these books, it makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they at the time, they said, well, what are we going to do? And we're going to read about it in a minute. But they wanted to start a chain of hospitals, because the chain thing, chain drug stores and chain movie theaters and chain, you know, Bill thought he could raise money on Wall Street and, you know. So a chain of drunk tank hospitals. Then we'd get a bunch of missionaries to go out and find the alcoholics to fill them to make money. And the third idea was a book, you know, and that's – and obviously the hospitals and the missionaries didn't work, but luckily the book did. So a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. And again, when I read this, especially by myself, dark world, I just skipped right over that. It was a dark world. You know, there was no AA. There was no answer for people like us. It was now time for the struggling groups to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination, with the get rich idea, bore fruit in the spring of 1939 with the publication of this volume. Membership now had reached about 100 men and one woman. The fledgling society, which was nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its book. The flying blind period ended, and AA entered a new phase of its pioneering time. So they wrote the book. By now there's 100 men and a woman named Florence Rankin. They want to name the book, and they had all sorts of ideas. You know, one was The Way Out. We were at the Way Out group last night. The Way Out, but that had been used already. We 100 men, but there was a woman, just one woman, so they couldn't say, you know, 99 men and a woman. And the thing is, by the time the book was actually published, she had drank. Florence Rankin drank, so... So they're having this meeting, and in the corner there's a guy doing the Thorazine shuffle, and he had come out of an asylum for the meeting, and he was with an attendant or a butler or something like that. And the story is, I don't know if it was drugs or I'm just naturally this way, but he was the publisher of some big magazine. And he was a big shot who had drank too much and was in an asylum. And he was with this guy, and as they're all going around, The Way Out, the Bill Wilson movement, Comes a Dawn was another one. This guy mumbles in the back, he mumbles out, Anonymous Alcoholics. And everybody stops and thinks about it and goes, no, not quite, you know, and they start going again. And then he yells out, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all look at each other and go, yeah, that's it, Alcoholics Anonymous. That's great. That's good. So that's what they named it. And then this guy was never seen again. You know, he came to one meeting, he named it, and he was never seen again. So, and that's kind of... So it says, with the appearance of the new book, a great deal happened. So anyway, they went broke. They went bankrupt publishing the book. They made every mistake they possibly could. They went bankrupt. But it says, and here they don't talk about that. They just say, with the appearance of the book, a great deal happened. Nothing happened for a while. They sold no books. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, noted clergyman, reviewed it with approval in the fall of 1939. Fulton Ulster, then editor of the Liberty, printed a piece in his magazine called Alcoholics and God. This brought in a rush, and this was a save the day, brought a rush of 800 frantic inquiries into our little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. And again, they opened this office, they can't pay for it. But each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Pamphlets and books were sent out. So they answered every single inquiry. They sent out a book. The one thing is that they just to sum up the big book thing, the last thing they did, and they owed everybody money, what they did was when they first time they ran out of money, a guy from New Jersey named Hank Parkers went to the drugstore, got a blank thing of stock certificates, and made up a company. And he wrote, you know, the Works Publishing Company. He filled it in with a pen. And not incorporated, not filed with the SEC, nothing. Just, and he came into a meeting like this and said, hey, guys, we're going to make $1 million on this book, and we're going to let you guys in on the ground floor. Buy a certificate. I know nobody has money because it's the Depression. Buy this for $25. Give me five now, and give me five every month, you know, and you'll own a share. There's only going to be 300 shares. Bill gets 100. I get 100 for organizing it. Bill wrote the book. And you guys will give you 100. And we're going to get so rich, it's unbelievable. So they fill out all these things. They sell them to all the people. Charlie Towns of the Towns Hospital bought $2,500 worth. And they blew that money. They were down to their last $500. And they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to send postcards to every doctor in the country, and we're going to tell them about this book. And when doctors see this and know, they realize, because it's like the cure for cancer, really, you know, when they see this, they will, every doctor, they'll all want 1,000 books, and that'll be it. So they took their last 500 for postage and cards, and they send these out, and they give it 2 weeks, and they say, or 3 weeks, and they say, okay, let's go. Bring five cars. We need at least five cars to bring all these cards back. You know, let's all go down to the post office and get and collect the cards and start sending out books. And they go down there and they look in their box, and there's, I think there was 13 cards. And they're like, holy shit, you know what? And so Hank Parkhurst goes, no, Bill, don't worry. You don't know how the post office works. They can only put those 13 cards in our little box. There's bags and bags and bags back there. So pull the van around the back and we'll load the bags. You know, so they go to the postmaster and say, where are the rest of our postcards? Where are our bags? And the guy's like, what are you talking about? That's it, man. That's it. Those 13 cards. And they looked at them, and it's like seven of them were illegible because they were filled out by drunk doctors. So, and that was the end of their money for like the third time. They were now really, really broke, you know. So anyway, so when they got these 800 inquiries and sold the books, that was a big, that was a really a lifesaver for these guys. And there was like 10 stories like that where they thought, this is the answer, and it wasn't, you know. So, this brought in, each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Okay, businessmen, anybody here a traveling salesman? No? Okay. So businessmen traveling out of existing groups were referred to these prospective newcomers. So there's a story of a guy, if you were a businessman, you would, and said, okay, I'm going to Atlanta. Like this guy said, I'm going to Atlanta for 4 days. They gave him 11 inquiries out of these 800. Here's 11 people in the Atlanta area, you know, and there's no Uber back then. you know, here's 11 people in your 4 days. I know you've got business meetings, but while you're there, you've got to call on all these 11 people and tell them what we're doing here in New York. So, yeah, this is how – and the guy's like, no problem, I'll do it, because they knew the only way to stay sober was to help other people. So that guy, you know – you know, you tell me to make 2 phone calls, and you know, I'm. You're asking me a lot. You know, these guys go see 11 people in those 4 days you're down there on business, and tell them about AA in New York. So, these people worked really, really, really hard. New groups started out, and it was found to the astonishment of everyone that AA's message could be transmitted in the mail as well as by word of mouth. So by the end of 1939, it was estimated that 800 alcoholics were on their way to recovery. So here's the big thing. This is what saved and changed and broke Bill's heart, but this saved AA. So in the spring of 1940, John D. Rockefeller, and again, there's John D. Rockefeller, their relationship with him goes back to like 1936. But in 1940, John D. Rockefeller gave a dinner for many of his friends, which he invited AA members to tell the story. And so again, it was like Carnegie and Mellon and J. Paul Getty and Rockefeller. You know, it's like having Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Steve Jobs and, you know, all these people. And there was a, at that time, 1930 or 1940, there was $1 billion of net worth in that room. And so again, Bill thought, this is it. We're set, you know. And it was at that dinner that John D. Rockefeller got up and said, we've discussed it, and we realize that this is an altruistic movement and that the worst thing we could do is give it money. And therefore, we're not giving you guys a penny, and we think this is wonderful, but we really think money would destroy it. And Bill Wilson, you read some of Bill's books, you know, his description, actually it's in that book there, AA Comes of Age, is he was devastated, you know, devastated, because they, again, they're broke and they think we're walking out of here with $1 million, you know, and they probably had that $1 million spent already. But that saved AA. John D. Rockefeller really, really saved AA by not giving us any money, and we'll get into that as we go along. But also, it says that here, news of this got out on the World Wires and inquiries poured in. So John D. Rockefeller said, this AA is great. You know, in his interview, he said, this is real, and it's saving lives, and it works, and it's great. And for John, it's like Warren Buffett saying it today, you know, just a guy that people believed, you know. So that really, you know, by vouching for us, John D. Rockefeller really saved us. And says, inquiries poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores and bought the book Alcoholics Anonymous. In the March of 1941, membership was up to 2,000. So here, and I used to skip over these, but now that I, you know, so Jack Alexander was an investigative reporter who had just spent 2 years on cracking some sort of case called the New Jersey Rackets. I don't know what they were, but he was an investigative reporter that would find phony schemes. So he had blown open this thing in New Jersey after 2 years of work, and his next assignment, his editor said, Jack, go check out this Alcoholics Anonymous and let's expose these guys as money grubbing, you know, that it's a scheme. And Jack said, no problem, I'll get them, you know. And Bill knew who Jack Alexander was, so when he showed up, Bill did say, Jack, I understand why you're here, but just before you even draw a conclusion, please go to 10 different AA meetings, and then we can talk, you know. And Jack Alexander did that, and long story short, he saw that AA was real, and then he wrote an article instead of how AA was a scam, that AA was real, saving lives, and that people were truly getting sober. And so when that article in the Saturday Evening Post placed such a compelling picture of AA before the general public that alcoholics in need of help really deluged us. And so that was big to kick AA off. These are all the things that saved AA from really almost going under. By the close of 41, we had 8,000 members. Society feels some excitement there as well. Skip a paragraph. It says, as we discovered the principles by which individual alcoholic could live, so we had to evolve principles by which the AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function. And this was, when you read AA Comes of Age, it is really explains how tough it was as this thing grew so big and so quickly, the problems that they had. And so they had to come up with their traditions. And the traditions are really important. It's funny, as I was getting ready for this, I remember early on in my AA, and I was in this room, on a Friday night they had a 7 o'clock meeting, and you hear this in AA a lot. They had a 7 o'clock meeting and then some sort of special 8 o'clock meeting. I forget what their gimmick was, but It was some sort of different meeting, and special problems meeting or something, you know. Problem is there'd be this amount of people at the 7 o'clock meeting, and there'd be four people at the later meeting. So these special people from their special meeting came to us and said, we don't have enough money to pay rent, so we want you guys to support us. And we had a business meeting on that. And it went on, you know, pro and con. Finally, somebody, this guy Pete Wade, just said, look, tradition four, each group is autonomous. You know, if they can't make it, they're out. You know, we can't support. And you hear, are there any AA-related announcements? This kind of drives me nuts. I understand it, but are there any AA? And you get a bunch of people who say, yeah, the group in South Orange could really use our help. If you guys could all go to the meeting in South Orange, you know, we'd appreciate it. You know, obviously the meeting in South Orange isn't delivering a good message because no one wants to go. You know, so you're asking us to go to a meeting that's not delivering a good message so that your meeting can stay alive, you know. So, I'm sure that we should be doing that. So anyway, AA groups as a whole could survive and function effectively. It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society, and these are all the kind of the things that, and in the beginning it was a little exclusive, and they realized they had to change it, so that our leaders might serve and never govern, that each group was to be autonomous, we just discussed that, and that there was to be no professional class of therapy. There would be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by our own contributions. And the other thing is, when Rockefeller, he did give us $3,000 for Dr. Bob to pay his mortgage and Bill and Bob. It might have been $5,000. And then they kept hitting, for a couple of years, they kept hitting the mailing list of Rockefeller's friends and raising about $3,000 a year. And once they got on their feet, they stopped that. And they were the only, AA is the only one who ever paid the Rockefeller Foundation back. They did pay that $5,000 back. Our expenses were being met by our own contributions. There was to be the least possible organization, even in our service center. So I read this last night. This is, I think, really important. In AA, we don't answer to anybody. We answer to two things. We answer to God, or we answer to liquor. And I read it last night. It said, Bill Wilson wrote, God says, I'm waiting for you to do my will. I think is how it goes. And John Barleycorn says, if you don't do God's will, I'll kill you. And we do. We die of drinking, you know. So and that's the beauty of AA. There's no president, or there's no authorities that when you're late you get scolded, or you're if you do something wrong, maybe your sponsor. I remember one time, and my sponsor said to me one time, because I, like a lot of people, I said, I came in and shared, like I always did, some sort of nonsense in my early days. And I said, first of all, Dave Alcoholic, I'm sorry I was late, but here's what happened to me today, and blah, 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 blah. And my sponsor just leans over and goes, hey, bozo, no one gives a shit that you were late, you know. And so I've never said that again. But whenever someone said, sorry I was late, and all I can think in my mind is, no one gives a shit that you were late. Try to keep that to myself. Our public relations are based on attraction rather than promotion, and that's attraction. Attraction is it. You know, I was in AA for 10 years, and I had a brother-in-law who drank, and he drank a lot, and he's now in the rooms. I think he's got 8 years. But at 10 years in here, we'd be on family vacations, and my parents were always like, oh, your poor sister and her husband, the poor them, they have it. I'm like, not poor them. If he would stop drinking, you know, who gives a shit about poor them? If he would stop drinking, you know, blah, blah. And I would always be a little passive-aggressive to them on vacations, because my parents kind of favored them and kind of enabled them, and it really rubbed me the wrong way. And finally my wife said to me, and she's got 27 years, she said to me, Dave, how do you ever expect Tim to come to AA if all he sees of AA is you acting like an asshole all the time, why would he ever want to go to AA when the face of AA is you being a jerk off, you know? Mm. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You're right. So I changed as much as I possibly could. I became less of a jerk off. And he has now got 8 years. So, but you won't find him at this meeting yet. Not that I judge. It was decided that all members ought to be autonomous. Under no circumstances we give endorsements. Okay. This was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which are on page 561. Blah, blah, blah. I just want to get this over with. So on the halfway down, page XX or 20, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious organization, but it certainly is a spiritual organization. Neither do we take any particular medical point of view, blah, blah, blah. This I like. Alcohol being no respecter of persons. We are an accurate cross-section of America, blah, 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 blah. So I am fortunate. I work with a lot of guys, and some of the guys I sponsor are in here. I read the big book almost every day with somebody, different guys. And I have sponsored CEOs of a CEO of a giant company, and he is not sober. And I have sponsored I took a guy, a dear friend, who came to me crying at 6 in the morning, drunk out of his mind on a work day. And so I took him to an AA meeting, and I was fairly new at the time. So I took him up to Summit, and I sat him in the back with all the other well-to-do businessmen, thinking he'd associate with them instead of, you know. And he sat through the meeting, and I said, so now these well-to-do businessmen, I'm not sure had ever read the big book, but they were well-to-do businessmen. nor had I read, this is my last big book here. It sat for 10 years, though, looking more like this big book, not getting... So after the meeting, I said, so what'd you think? You know, of course, we really want to help people. I'm like, so we're walking out. I'm like, what'd you think? He goes, you know, that was really a nice group of people. And I would like to donate a large sum of money, but it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I just said, no problem, make the check out to Dave Hall. But, you know, just when it says it's no respecter of persons, and, you know, I just find the smarter certainly me, and believe me, I thought I was smart, and trust me, I'm not. But I thought I was too smart for AA, and that's why it took me 7 years to to get going. It says here our present membership is pyramiding at about 20% a year, and that's not true anymore. We're kind of capped at about 2 million. It says the problem of several million potential alcoholics in the world, we have made only a scratch. In all probability, we shall never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcohol problem. Upon therapy for alcoholics himself, we surely have no monopoly, and that's that's what I love about this book. It's, you know, they say we have no monopoly, and when you get to page 164, you know, when you get to finish this, it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. You know, oh, they sure shit knew more than everybody else, but, you know, I just really like the humility of the book. Okay, let's skip now, because I don't... in the forward to the third edition, the only thing I really like to point out is that in spite of the great increase in size and the span of this fellowship, at its core, it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And I really don't do much on the forward to the fourth edition. I'm trying to. You know, Dr. Bob took, you know, and it was different. But Dr. Bob took 5,000 people through the steps. He took like three people a day through the steps. If you do the math, now it was different because in the early days, if Matt, we get Matt, I like picking on him, We would take Matt, if he was a problem, we'd take him to the Akron City Hospital. And we put him in a room with nothing but a Bible. And the first day, you and I would go see him. And then the next day, I guess we would try to keep it all men, but there's only like 10 people in the group. So while Matt's in the hospital, 10 people would go and see him, two a day, and share their story about alcoholism. And Matt would be in his hospital bed. And then when he was done, Dr. Bob would come in. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bob, after he had met with these people, Dr. Bob would just simply come in and say, are you an alcoholic? Yes. Are you ready to turn your will and life over to God? Yes. Get on your knees. Say this prayer, and so on. And that was really what he did. But Dr. Bob, the story goes, took 5,000 people through the steps. And I do it too slowly. That's one thing with anything we do in AA. We're always trying to get better at it, telling our first step experience, sharing hope, whatever it is. I really try to get better and better at it. Just to try to be more effective. Obviously, it all has to do with God, but I got to do whatever I possibly can. So now we're going to go to the doctors. Holy shit. Doctor's opinion. I'm going to read the first part of the doctor's opinion. So Dr. Silkworth was a doctor who lost all his money in the Depression. Dr. Silkworth is one of the most important people to all of us in this room. And for those who don't know what he looks like, this is Dr. William D. Silkworth. And he has saved all your lives, at least for today. All right? Mm-hmm. That and the other picture I like. This is the first coffee pot ever in AA. That's one from that Bill and Bob had their pot of coffee. For some reason, that strikes me as a good one. Silkworth was he was unemployed, lost everything in the crash, and was out of work. And he went to his friend Charlie Towns and said, "Do you have anything?" And he said, "All he's got really is the drunk tank, downstairs in the basement. You can go run the drunk tank." And Silkworth did have interest in alcohol, the alcohol problem. So he said, "Okay, I'll go down there." So again, there's no AA. There's no such thing as AA. You live in Texas. You're dying of alcohol. You've had this book sent to you trying to find an answer. And you get to the doctor's opinion, and they're trying to sell you. Dr. Silkworth is trying to sell you on this. And it says here, this is Bill's writing, as you can tell. And by the way, Ann Smith wrote the chapter on two wives, mm-hmm. You can see the difference. I wish Ann Smith wrote the whole book. It says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe the reader, so we believe you will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book." So we're trying to validate what we have here by a doctor, backing us up here. It says, convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. And that's all true. But this part, it says, a well-known doctor, nobody knew Silkworth, chief physician, he ran the drunk tank, at a nationally prominent hospital, a dump in New York City, specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave us, now maybe by 1939, because it had, but when Silkworth started, the town's hospital was a private little hospital. So Silkworth writes here, it says, "I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years," and this is Silkworth, so you can believe this. "In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was the alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless." And Silkworth had seen, by the time Bill got there, he'd seen thousands of people. We came in drunk. Again, there's no AA. You came in, they put you on a gurney, put you in the hallway, or, till you slept it off. Silkworth would do whatever he could. And so he had seen a lot. But it says here, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning the possible means of recovery. And as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, and this is impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. And, you know, out of the Oxford group, there was about 10 or 15 books written by people who overcame their drinking. They, you know, how I was saved by the, my dark days of alcohol saved by the Oxford group. There was a lot of books written. The difference between those books and Bill Wilson's was, his thing was, I've recovered through the help of God, and I must, you know, share it with you, and you must share it with the next guy. And that was what the difference, you know, the big thing with Bill Wilson. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others have appeared to, again, recover. I personally know scores of cases who were the type with whom every other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme importance because of, and so again, I took this, this didn't mean anything to me, but again, if there's no AA and you're so desperate, as I know I was at one moment of my life, this would mean a lot to me. It says, because of the extraordinary possibilities and the rapid growth inherent in this group, they may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands, you know, that's what they all they could see at the time, thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves, Doctor. So Silkworth did not sign this in 1939, or he would have been whatever, kicked out of, he would have been dis-doctored, whatever.
Dis-doctored.
And he knew that, so he did not. He did not put his name. The second letter we'll read next week comes out in 1955, and now there's 150,000 people recovered. And people, and when this came out, the medical community just said, this is a crock of shit. It's a money-making scheme, you know. But in 1955, and I wish it actually stayed that way, in 1955, when there's huge success, and you've got Rockefeller and all this other, you know, the American Medical Association deems that alcoholism is, in fact, a disease. Mm. It's not weak will. It's not an immoral thing. It's not, and they deem it a disease. And when they did that, that's when insurance companies could get involved, and money got involved, and the recovery rate, which we'll read next week, went from about 75% down to 5%. So, but Silkworth did sign his name to that one, you know. So that's it for me tonight. Thanks.
Thank you.